Hello, and welcome to Malice Aforethought UK, a true crime podcast which tells some of the famous, infamous, and lesser known crimes here in the UK and across the globe. Today we are going over to Australia and we're going to tell the story of the horrendous death of Pricey. Pricey's killer was a woman known as Catherine Knight, and she was the first woman in Australia to be sentenced to life imprisonment without parole when she was convicted of the murder of her partner, John Charles Thomas Price, known as Pricey, in February 2000. Born in 1955, what could a woman of 45 years old and a mother of four children do to be handed this type of sentence in court and be so infamous as to be known as the only woman and the first woman in Australia to be given a whole life tariff? So to start answering the questions as to what made her do it and why she is so infamous in Australia, we have to go back and look at the dysfunctional upbringing and life of Knight. And we're going way back into the past to start by reviewing the lives of her parents, Barbara Ruin and Ken Knight. So Barbara Ruin, whose maiden name was Thorley, was initially married to her husband Jack Ruin, with whom she had four sons, when she met and began an adulterous relationship with her husband's friend, who is Catherine's father, Ken Knight. Not a sin by today's standard, but Barbara did live in the early 1950s with her family in an extremely conservative, with a little c, small town of Aberdeen in New South Wales in the Hunter Valley area of Australia. Even according to the 2016 census, Aberdeen is not a place one would describe as cosmopolitan. The population in 2016 was 1,894 people, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people only make up 6.7% of the population. 86.7% of the population were born in Australia, and 90.4% of people only spoke English at home. And the most common responses for religion were Anglican at 34% and Catholic at 28%. So it's no surprise that in such a small place, the Ruin and Knight families were well known and the affair caused quite a scandal. Due to the locals ostracising Barbara for this, she and Ken were forced to leave town and she left her husband and four sons behind. This resulted in the two youngest boys going to live in Sydney with an aunt, while the older boys remained in Aberdeen with their father. So Barbara and Ken's relationship did not get off to the best of starts, but they settled down together, eventually having two children. And by the time Catherine and her twin sister Joy were born in 1955, the family were living in Tentfield, New South Wales. Then, when the twins were about 4 years old in 1959, Barbara's husband Jack Ruin died, and the two elder sons, who had remained with him when Barbara left, came to live with Barbara and the Knight family. So despite leaving her husband and children for Ken Knight, Barbara found the grass was not always greener. Ken was an alcoholic and was known to be violent and abusive. He would often rape Barbara in front of the children, which caused her to preach what could only be described as misandry, which is a hatred on men and boys, to her daughters. She would overshare sexually explicit stories with them about intimate details of her relationship and sex life with their father, and was unsympathetic to her daughter Catherine's claims that she was being sexually abused. Not long after the death of her husband, Ken and Barbara returned to the hometown of Aberdeen, and Catherine attended Muswell Brook High School. At this stage, she was a teenager and she seemed to be a person of two halves. When she was happy, she was known to be a model pupil, a learner, but she would receive awards for good behaviour and people described her as pleasant. but occasionally she could be driven into an uncontrollable rage and would bully younger children. So Catherine was by all accounts mainly a pleasant girl who experienced uncontrollable murderous rages in response to minor upsets, and there is known to be an occasion where she assaulted at least one boy at school with a weapon and was once injured by a teacher who was found to have had to act this way in self-defence. That said, despite attending school and often winning awards for being a model pupil, she never actually learned to read and write, and at 15 she left school illiterate and sought work. Her first job on leaving school was a cutter in a clothing factory, but she soon left that job and joined her sister Joy and her father Ken about a year later to start work as what she told people was her dream job at the local abattoir, which is a place where animals are butchered, a slaughterhouse. Her first job there was cutting up offal, but she excelled at the abattoir and quickly was promoted to boning and was given her own set of butcher's knives. In 1974, at the tender age of 18, she was working at the slaughterhouse and her main role was decapitating pigs. So Catherine took great interest in her job and would often wander around at the start of the production line and watch the pigs actually having their throats cut. Other employees found her macabre interest a little strange, but just assumed she was looking at other areas of the job. And even at this young age, Knight showed signs of further troubling behaviour, such as hanging her work set of butcher knives over her bed at night and claiming she liked to keep them handy in case they were needed. This was a habit she continued throughout her life until she was finally arrested. She was also well known about town, offering anyone who upset her armed combat to settle their differences. All of this is possibly a sign of trauma she'd experienced at the hands of her parents and abusers when she was a child. Also at the age of 18, Knight met David Stanford Kellett. He was a driver and also worked at the abattoir. David was himself suffering from trauma. He was known to be violent, often getting into fights, and this was probably due to the fact he was an alcoholic. Kellett had lost his job at the railroad, which he'd held previous to joining the abattoir, due to his behaviour. At the railroad job, he'd found himself in two very serious incidents which probably resulted in his turning to drink. The first was when his best friend was killed in front of him in a shunting accident, and later when he rescued injured occupants of a school bus which had been struck by a train. Unfortunately, six children were killed in that accident and Kellett was there rescuing people, and that had had a really severe effect on his mental health. So the two of them, Kellett and Knight, were known about town as a couple to avoid. They were often getting into fights where both would just wade in. They were riding around on Kellett's motorcycle and basically making a show of themselves. But that did not stop them getting married not long after they met. Unconventionally, they turned up drunk to their own wedding on Kellett's motorbike, with Knight riding and Kellett on the pillion. Again, like her parents' marriage, the bliss was short-lived. In fact, only a few hours into their marriage, on their wedding night, Knight tried to strangle her new husband. The reason? He had the audacity to fall asleep on their wedding night after only having sex three times. It did not stop there. Knight was known to be extremely violent and abusive to Kellett, and even though she soon became pregnant, that did not seem to slow her temper down. When she was heavily pregnant, she burned all of her husband's clothing and shoes because he had arrived home late from a darts competition after reaching the final. When he did arrive home, she hit him across the head with a frying pan. He managed to escape to a neighbour's house where he collapsed and was treated in hospital for a fractured skull. The police wanted to charge Knight with this assault, but she managed to creep around her husband and talked him into dropping the charges. In 1976, 2 years into their marriage, their daughter Melissa Ann was born, and Kellett soon after left Knight for another woman, escaping to Queensland, claiming the violence and abuse he suffered just got too much for him. At this point, Knight turned her abusive tendencies onto their baby, and after being seen acting violently with the baby, she was admitted to St Elmo's Hospital in Tamworth, where she was diagnosed with postnatal depression and spent several weeks recovering. After being released, Knight placed two-month-old Melissa on a railway line shortly before a train was due. She then stole an axe, went into town and threatened to kill several people. A vagrant known in the district as Old Ted, who happened to be foraging near the railway line, found and rescued baby Melissa only minutes before the train passed. Knight was arrested again, taken to St Elmo's Hospital, but apparently made a miraculous recovery and was signed out the following day. Then only a few days later, Knight slashed the face of a woman with one of her knives and demanded she drive her to Queensland to find Kellett. The woman escaped after they stopped at a service station, but by the time the police arrived, Knight had taken a young boy hostage and was threatening him with her butcher's knives. Knight was disarmed when police attacked her with brooms, and she was admitted this time to the Morisset Psychiatric Hospital. She told nurses she had intended to kill the mechanic at the service station because he had repaired the car that her husband had left in to go to Queensland. She was then going to go and kill both her husband and his mother, her mother-in-law, when she arrived in Queensland. When police informed Kellett of the incident, he left his girlfriend and moved back to his hometown of Aberdeen with his mother to support his ex-wife. When Knight was released on the 9th of August 1976, she went into the care of her mother-in-law, and along with her ex-husband, Kellett, they moved to Ipswich, a city west of Brisbane, and she obtained a job at the Dinmore Meatworks. At that point, her relationship with Kellett rekindled, and they went on to have a second daughter in March of 1983, who they named Natasha Marie. In 1984, Knight did leave Kellett and moved first back to her parents' house in Aberdeen, then to a rented house in nearby Muswellbrook. Although she returned to work as her old job at the abattoir, she injured her back the following year and ended up on a disability pension. So in 1986, with two young daughters in tow, Knight met 38-year-old miner David Saunders. A few months later, he moved in with her and her daughters, but he kept his old apartment, and Catherine Knight hated this. She'd fly into a jealous rage regarding what he did when she was not around and would often throw him out. He would then move back to his apartment, she would turn up, beg him to return, and the whole circle would go round again. Then in May 1987, she cut the throat of his two-month-old dingo pup in front of him for no more reason than as to set an example as to what would happen if he ever slept with someone else behind her back. She then went on to knock him unconscious with a frying pan. In June of 1988, she gave birth to a third daughter, this time with Saunders, and named the little girl Sarah. This prompted Saunders to put a deposit on a house, and Knight eventually paid the deposit off when her workers' compensation came through in 1989. Knight decorated the house throughout with animal skins, skulls, horns, rusty animal traps, leather jackets, old boots, machetes, rakes and pitchforks. No space, including the ceilings, were left uncovered. Must have been quite a sight. Like the first David, David Saunders often got physically abused by Catherine Knight. David Saunders took a long service leave and went into hiding after a particularly violent fight where Catherine had smashed his face with an iron and stabbed him in the stomach with a pair of scissors. He moved back to his apartment in nearby Scone, but when he returned home to Aberdeen, he found she had cut up all his clothes. Once David Saunders went into hiding, Knight tried everything she could to find him, but no one would admit to knowing his whereabouts. However, several months later, Saunders returned to see his daughter Sarah, and at that stage he found that Knight had gone to the police and told them that she was afraid of him. In fact, she had had him issued with an apprehended violence order, an AVO. So in the state of New South Wales, a court may grant an apprehended violence order to a person who fears violence, harassment, abuse or stalking. The order prohibits the defendant from assaulting, harassing, threatening, stalking or intimidating the person seeking the order. Other conditions may be included, such as a prohibition against contacting the person or attempting to find the person online. A court may issue the order if it believes a person has reasonable grounds for fear. A non-compliance could result in the imposition of a fine, imprisonment or both, and deportation. So even though David had gone into hiding and was the victim and had been assaulted, she had in fact had this order, this injunction, issued against him. So by the time Saunders left her, she was unable to work, she was bringing up three daughters to two different men, and she was looking for her next relationship. This time she began a relationship with a former colleague from the abattoir, John Chillingworth. He was 43, and in 1990, Knight became pregnant for a fourth time by John and gave birth that year to a boy named Eric. Their relationship lasted 3 years, and it seems to be fairly uneventful, bearing in mind her previous quite toxic and violent relationships. And the only reason I can think of is because she had no reason to feel jealous of John, as it was in fact her that was cheating on him in this relationship, so she wasn't worried about him cheating on her. In fact, she was having a relationship with another John, John Price, and eventually she left John Chillingworth for John Price. John Price was known as Pricey. He was a single dad. He'd divorced a few years earlier. He had three children. The youngest lived with his ex-wife, and the two older children lived with him. Knight, at this point, had four children, three girls and a boy. And everyone knew Pricey to be a terrific bloke, and he was well liked by everyone who knew him. Pricey was well aware of Knight's violent reputation around the area, but nevertheless, they moved in together. In fact, she moved into his house in 1995. His children quite liked her. He was making a lot of money working in the local mines, and apart from the odd violent argument, he claimed that life was a bunch of roses. But in 1998, they had a fight over Price's refusal to marry her. And in retaliation, Knight videotaped items he had, in inverted commas, stolen from work and sent the tape to his boss. Although the items were actually out-of-date medical kits that he'd scavenged from the company Rubbish Tip, Price was fired from his job that he'd had for 17 years. So that same day he kicked her out and she returned to her own home while news of what she had done to her partner spread around town. So despite the fact that they were the local gossip, everyone knew what she was like as a person, and the fact she'd caused him to lose his job of 17 years, it still wasn't the end for the two of them in their relationship. John and Catherine were back together a few months later, but he still refused to marry her. The fighting became even more frequent, and most of his friends would no longer have anything to do with him and said they wouldn't have anything to do with him while he was still with her. They fought constantly, with Catherine becoming more and more violent. In 2000, she stabbed John in the chest, and on the 29th of February that year, finally fed up, he kicked her out the house. On his way to work, he stopped at the Scone Magistrates Court and took out a restraining order to keep her away from him and his children. That was the beginning of the end. That afternoon, Price told his co-workers that if he didn't come into work the next day, it would be that because she had killed him, because he'd been to court about her. He wasn't wrong. Those were very famous last words. His co-workers begged him not to go home, but he told them that he believed she would kill his children if he didn't. So when Price arrived home that night, he found that Knight wasn't there. But neither were the children. She had sent them away for a sleepover at a friend's house. So he spent the evening with his neighbours, then he went home and went to bed about 11 o'clock. During that night, Knight turned up at his apartment wearing some new sexy black lingerie she had bought early in the day, and she woke him up for sex. He had work the next day, so he went to sleep straight afterwards. Unbeknown to him, Knight had had a busy day of planning. Not only had she bought the sexy underwear to tempt him with, but she had videotaped all her children while making some strange comments, which have since been interpreted as her attempt at a crude will, last will and testament. Once Price had rung the police, Knight began planning his demise. She went out, she bought a sexy black nightie for the evening, and she had even hidden a butcher's knife in the bedroom. Had Pricey not been so vocal in his comments to the people around him about his fears for his safety, his car still being on the driveway at 6 a.m. the next morning probably would not have attracted too much attention. But everyone knew about Catherine Knight and her strange behaviour in the town. So seeing the car had not moved the following morning, a neighbour became concerned. And when Price did not arrive at work, his employer sent a co-worker around to his apartment to check on him. The concerned neighbour and the colleague tried knocking on Price's bedroom window to wake him, but after noticing blood on the front door, they alerted the police, who arrived at 8 a.m. Breaking down the back door, police found his body with Knight comatose from taking a large number of pills. She had stabbed Price with a butcher's knife while he had been sleeping. The crime scene was so horrific that several police officers actually quit, while some refused to eat meat for months. The following account is the complete report by crime scene investigator, Detective Senior Constable Peter Ann Musio, who was the first officer into the premises after the initial discovery of John Price's body. This is his report of the scene. About 10 a.m, Wednesday the 1st of March 2000, in company with Detective Sergeant Neil Raymond, I attended the premises at 84 St Andrew Street, Aberdeen, in relation to an alleged homicide. There I spoke to a number of police, including Duty Officer Graham Fairlonger, Detective Sergeant Bob Wells, and Senior Constable Michael Prentice. The premises is a single-storey, three-bedroom dwelling which faces generally south onto St Andrew Street. The premises was built towards the eastern side of the block, leaving a grassed area on the western side where three vehicles were parked. These vehicles consisted of a white Toyota four-wheel drive, a white Ford sedan, and a white Toyota Land Cruiser utility. There were two galvanized steel garn sheds in the rear yard, one at each rear corner. There was also a brick barbecue against the eastern boundary. The dwelling had a full-length veranda across the southern side and a smaller veranda central to the rear of the premises. My attention was drawn to a piece of cooked meat on the rear lawn in the front of the white Ford sedan. I made an examination of this piece of meat and collected it for further testing. During my examination, I took a series of photographs of the premises and the piece of cooked meat on the lawn. I entered the premises to conduct a cursory examination with Detective Sergeant Raymond. I walked in through the rear door and into the kitchen. Once inside the kitchen, I saw a large section of what appeared to be human skin hanging from the top architrave of the doorway leading onto the lounge room. This piece of skin extended from the top of the doorway right to the floor and appeared to be an entire human skin. Looking through this doorway into the lounge room, I could see a headless and skinless human body. I walked east along the hallway and looked into the entry foyer and saw an extreme amount of blood pooled on the floor. There was also a large amount of blood smearing over the eastern wall of the entry. I walked further east along the hallway and noticed some blood staining leading onto the main bedroom. In this bedroom, I noticed more blood staining, however, only moderate amounts. I then left the scene and had a discussion with Sergeant Raymond and other investigating police outside the scene. I then re-entered the premises and made a more detailed examination. The rear door of the premises opens into the laundry. Off the western side of this is the kitchen dining room. The laundry contained a stainless steel tub in the northeast corner and a washing machine further south along the eastern wall. There was a built-in cupboard in two separate wooden louvered doors in the southern wall of the laundry. On the western wall of the laundry was a cavity sliding door that gave access to the dining room and kitchen. The room was divided into two sections, with the kitchen being the western end and the dining room being the eastern end. The dining room contained a wood and steel dining room table, which had three matching seats placed around it. There were items of clothing draped over the backs of each of the three chairs. On the dining room table was a tool bag, some clothing, a small blue folder, an electric toy gorilla, and some prescription medicine bottles. I noticed blood staining to the shoulder area of a blue shirt, which was draped over the chair on the western side of the table. The medication on the table consisted of three boxes of Felidor ER 5 mg, of which two were empty. This medication normally contains two strips of each containing 15 tablets. However, there were only one full strip containing 15 tablets. There was also one empty box of Prinvil 20 tablets, an empty box of Dapper tabs was also on the table. This medication, when full, contains 90 tablets at 2.5 milligrams. The fourth chair of the set was against the northern wall under the bench portion of the breakfast bar. I took a series of photographs of the dining room. The kitchen was in the east portion of the room. It consisted of a kitchen bench with overhead cupboards along the eastern wall. About central to this bench was an electric cooktop, which had a baking dish and an aluminium boiler on it. Along the southern wall was a wall oven, and further east was a two-door built-in pantry and a freestanding fridge. Along the northern wall was another bench which incorporated the sink, and further east was a breakfast bar that protruded from the northern wall south into the kitchen and divided the kitchen and dining room. As mentioned earlier, I saw what appeared to be a complete human skin or pelt hanging from the top architrave of the door separating the dining room and the lounge room. On closer examination, I could distinguish black curly hair at the top, a nose, and part of the mouth and ear. About halfway down the pelt, I could see a clump of short black curly hair consistent with pubic hair. I could not recognize any other particular features as it continued to the floor. The edges of the pelt were incised, indicating to me that it had been removed with a sharp instrument. There were also a number of distinct stab wounds to the pelt, about a metre down from the top. The pelt was attached to the architrave by a stainless steel meat hook. The hook was pierced through the top of the head area of the pelt, and then hooked over the architrave on the lounge room side of the door. The skin appeared to vary in thickness from approximately 1 to 4 centimetres. I noticed a blood trail leading from the lounge room into the kitchen towards the kitchen cooktop in the vicinity of the aluminium boiler. The boiler was on the right side rear element, which was at the time turned off. When I lifted the lid to the boiler, I noticed it was warm to the touch. The pot was full of a liquid, and on the surface I could identify a skinned human head and number of cooked vegetables. On the northern side of the aluminium boiler, I saw a baking dish, which was sitting across the right front side element. Inside the baking dish, I saw an amount of liquid and the remains of baked vegetables. Just to the right, on northern side of the cooktop, I saw prepared meals. Each of the meals consisted of two pieces of cooked meat, baked potato, baked pumpkin, zucchini, or as we call it in the UK, courgette, cabbage, yellow squash, and gravy. Underneath each of the meals was a torn section of kitchen paper with a name written on it. The word Beaky was written in blue ink pen on one of the pieces, while the word Jonathan was on the other. The pieces of meat appeared on the plates were similar to the pieces I had collected from the real lawn. On the section of the kitchen bench across the northern wall were a number of items of interest. On the western end of the bench, I saw a green electric jug with blood staining about the handle. In the sink, I saw an orange-coloured vegetable peeler and the vegetable peelings from potato, pumpkin, zucchini and onion. On the eastern side of the sink, I saw a cream-coloured microwave dish containing a cooked cabbage and clearish liquid. In front of the microwave dish, I saw a brown-coloured coffee cup that was sitting on a wooden cutting board. Inside the coffee cup was a teaspoon and a small quantity of thick brown liquid similar to gravy. There was also the residue of gravy type substance on the cutting up board. Just to the right of the cutting up board was a yellow handled Swiber knife and two forks. The handle of the knife was bloodstained. On the eastern side of the breakfast bar, I saw a small black handled knife which was bloodstained and four empty medication blister packs. One blister pack was labelled Lovox and had 15 tablets missing. Two blister packets labelled Arapax and had 10 tablets missing from each packet, and a blister pack labelled Promethazine had 20 tablets missing. I saw a blood-stained grey coffee cup which contained a fatty white substance. There was also an empty Tui's brand beer stubby, a pair of packet of Winfield red cigarettes, and a black wallet belonging to the deceased on the bench. On the western side of the breakfast bar, I saw a Norton brand bench stone, sharpening stone. On the southern side of the cooktop, on the bench against the western wall of the kitchen, was a microwave oven. In front of the microwave was the remains of a roll of paper towel and a blue plastic lid. This lid fitted on the microwave dish that was on the kitchen sink. I also noted that the microwave door was open and the courtesy light was on. On the cork-tiled floor of the kitchen at the southern west corner of the kitchen bench, I saw a blood-stained bare footprint. This footprint was from the right foot of a person, and at the time, the person was standing adjacent to the kitchen bench with the right foot facing north. I noticed blood staining to the fridge on both the handle of the door to the fridge section and the eastern side of the unit. The staining to the door handle contained some ridge structure and was in a position consistent with opening the door with bloodied hands. There was also smears on the eastern face of the fridge and lower down staining from droplets of blood that had come into contact with this surface. As mentioned earlier, the lounge room was off the southern side of the kitchen dining room, the two rooms being separated by a cavity sliding door. On the eastern side of the lounge room was an opening of 0.6 metres wide, which gave access to the front entry of the premises. The lounge room contained a single seat lounge chair in the southeast corner, and further west against the wall was a three-seater lounge suite and another single lounge seat in the southwest corner. From this corner north, against the western wall, was a slow combustion heater and another single lounge chair. Along the northern wall from the northwestern corner was a large wooden display cabinet, a smaller display cabinet, the doorway to the kitchen dining room, and a single lounge chair in the northeastern corner. The skinless and headless body of a person now known to me as John Charles Price was in a supine position, with his legs protruding into the entry foyer from the knees down. There was a substantial amount of blood smeared over the carpet around the body. As mentioned earlier, there was also an extreme amount of blood pooling on the floor of the entry foyer. In this blood pool and staining were marks where the body of the deceased had been dragged about 1 meter from about the middle of the entry foyer onto the carpet in the lounge room. The deceased was laying on his back with his legs crossed at the feet. The left ankle was on top of the right. His left arm was extended out from the body at an angle of about 45 degrees. Under the left wrist of this arm was an empty plastic 1.25 litre Shelley's Club lemon squash bottle. The right arm was also extended and lying alongside the body. On the floor, adjacent to the right arm of the deceased, was a blood-stained 31-centimetre yellow plastic-handled knife. The blade of this knife was 17.5 centimetres long. The body was virtually devoid of skin and flesh, exposing the muscles and some organs. There were a number of wounds present on the body, one of the most obvious being a stab wound to the left side of the chest, which extended into the chest cavity. As stated, the body had been skinned in a manner that leads me to believe that the person responsible would have had the skill in this area. From the blood staining on the carpet, I was able to determine that the deceased had been skinned prior to being decapitated. There was a definite outline of the head in the blood staining on the carpet. Examination of the neck region of the deceased indicated that the head had been removed very carefully and cleanly with a sharp instrument. On the seat of the single lounge chair in the northeast corner of the room, adjacent to the shoulders of the deceased, was a black-handled honing steel sharpening stone and an opened packet of Winfield Blue cigarettes. I also noticed bloodied handprints on the back and arms of the chair. On the northern wall on the western side of the door to the kitchen was a small display cabinet. Lying on this cabinet was a broken picture frame containing a picture of the deceased. Lying on top of the picture frame was a blood-stained watch. To the west of the photograph, still on top of the cabinet, was a blood-stained handwritten note, together with another broken picture on top of it. Apart from being blood-stained, it had small pieces of flesh on it. According to the blood evidence, he awoke and tried to turn the lights on before attempting to escape, while night chased him through the house. He managed to open the front door and get outside, but either stumbled back inside or was dragged back into the hallway, where he finally died after bleeding out. Later, Knight went into Aberdeen and withdrew $1,000 from Price's bank account using a cash machine. Price's autopsy revealed that he had been stabbed at least 37 times in both the front and back of his body, with many of the wounds extending into vital organs. Several hours after Price had died, Knight skinned him and hung the skin from a meat hook. His head was cooking in a stew on the stove. The pot was still warm, estimated to be between 40 and 50 degrees Celsius, indicating that cooking had taken place in the early morning. Knight had planned everything. The sexy undies, the pills, the late night visit for sex. She also made sure she had the right pots for his head and that her knives were sharp enough for the event. Even planning the murder and mutilation seemed to be pleasurable for this woman. She had decapitated him, cooked parts of his body, serving up the meat with baked potatoes, pumpkins, courgettes, cabbage, squash, and a gravy in two settings at the dinner table, along with notes beside each plate, each having the name of one of Price's children on it. So it would seem she was preparing to serve his body parts to his children, Beck, Ross, and John Jr., who was also known as Little John. A third meal had been thrown on the back lawn, and it was speculated that Knight had attempted to eat it herself but could not manage. Sometime later, Knight had then arranged the body with the left arm draped over the soft drink bottle and the legs crossed. It was claimed in court that this was an act of defilement, demonstrating her contempt for Price. The police mentioned the handwritten note on top of the photographs of Price and blood-stained covered pieces of flesh on it. The note read, "Time got you back, Jonathan, for rapping my daughter. You, Beck, for Ross, Little John, now play with Little John's dick, John Price." Now, obviously, as mentioned right at the beginning of this episode, when she left school, she could not read and write. So the emphasis on the misspelling is purely to indicate the difficulty that she had writing the note, but also that this was evident that it was definitely her that had written the note. So it was transcribed as saying, "Time I got you back, Jonathan, for raping my daughter. To you, Becky, Ross and Little John, now play with John's dick, John Price." Just to confirm her accusation, despite the fact it was very poorly written due to her illiteracy, was investigated by the police and it was totally groundless. There was no evidence whatsoever or any corroboration that John had interfered with or raped her daughter. Knight initially offered the Crown in Australia a guilty plea to manslaughter. However, the state rejected this and charged her with murder, and at that point she entered a plea of not guilty. Her trial was initially fixed for the 23rd of July in 2001, but was adjourned due to the illness of her defence barrister, and the trial eventually took place later that year in October 2001. A group of 60 people were up for jury selection, but following an offer by the judge to be excused due to the nature of the photographs and the evidence, five accepted that immediately and dropped out of the jury pool, and that left a pool of 55 prospective jurors. But once the witness list was read out, several more dropped out due to personal circumstances. This was a very small community, very close-knit, so a lot of people would have known each other or known of people involved in the case. So eventually, after the second round of dropouts, they were able to whittle the jury right down and that jury was selected. Knight's defence then spoke to the judge on a sidebar. They asked to speak to the judge in private. And at that point, the jury then adjourned the case to the next day. So the jury was sent home, the judge adjourned, and the next morning, everybody turned up at court to find that Knight had in fact changed her plea to guilty. So the jury was then dismissed. And it was then made public that Justice O'Keefe had been advised the night before when her barrister had spoken to him of her wish to change her plea to guilty. But he had adjourned and ordered a psychiatric assessment to take place overnight to determine if Knight understood the consequence of her guilty plea and was in fact mentally fit to make such plea. Knight's legal team had planned to defend Knight, claiming she had amnesia and dissociation, and this had been supported by some of the
psychiatrist who had spoken to her while she was on remand, but most of them did consider she was sane. So the judge wanted to know that even though she was in a way sane, bearing in mind her disassociation and amnesia, did she understand by pleading guilty the difference that this would make? So no reason was ever given for her change of pleas guilty. And despite giving it, Knight still refused to accept responsibility for her actions. At the sentencing hearing, Knight's lawyers requested that Knight be excused because she didn't want to hear some of the facts of what she had done, but the judge refused that application. When Dr. Timothy Lyons took the stand to describe the skinning and decapitation during the sentencing hearing, Knight became hysterical and had to be sedated. Now, during all of this, one of Australia's foremost criminal psychologists, Dr. Milton, had been asked to discuss his findings after interviewing Knight. And Dr. Milton said that Knight suffered from borderline personality disorder, but in fact knew exactly what she was doing on the evening of February. So concluding to the Newcastle Supreme Court trial, Judge O'Keefe stated, "Catherine Mary Knight, you have pleaded guilty and have been convicted of the murder of John Charles Price at Aberdeen on or about February 29th, 2000. In respect of your crime, I sentence you to imprisonment for life." Justice O'Keefe pointed out that the nature of the crime and Knight's lack of remorse required a severe penalty. He sentenced her to life imprisonment, refused to fix a non-parole period, and ordered that her papers be marked never to be released. This is the first time this had ever been imposed on a woman in Australian history. He further went on to say that the last minutes of his life, meaning John Price, must have been a time of abject terror for him, as there were a time of utter enjoyment for her. She has not expressed any contrition or remorse, and if released, she poses a serious threat to the security of society. Catherine Knight is the most notorious Australian female murderer of all time. It was quite clear that Knight was not a woman to cross. Ex-lovers and family members came forward during the investigation and the sentencing hearing to explain the violence that the woman was capable of. Knight's ex-husband told the packed court that Knight had once cut the throat of his 8-week-old puppy. Another time she sent the film of the stolen first aid kit to his boss at work, who had then fired him. She was portrayed as vindictive and cruel, who harmed anyone who crossed her. Yet to look at her sitting in the dock during the trial, many had commented that she looked like anyone's mother, a meek and mild looking woman who hid the facade of a monster. In June 2006, Knight appealed the life sentence, claiming that a penalty of life in jail without the possibility of parole was too severe for the killing. Justices Peter McLennan, Michael Adams and Megan Latham dismissed that appeal in the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal, with Justice McLennan writing in his judgment, "This was an appalling crime, almost beyond contemplation in a civilised society." So where is Knight now? Well, she is currently still serving her sentence at the Silverwater Women's Correctional Centre, and to this day she still claims her innocence. She maintains she remembers nothing of the incident and she committed no conscious crime. In prison, Knight works as a cleaner in the governor's office. She is known within the prison to be a very good cook, but does not work in the prison kitchen. In a point of humour, it can only be assumed they don't allow her access to knives and food preparation. So there you go. That's quite a stomach-churning story. I did try and find out some information about what happened to the three children of John. I presume that they went to live with their mother, but there doesn't seem to be that much information out there. And obviously, there is also the allegations that Catherine Knight made against Price in relation to her victim, but as this was fully investigated by the police and they could find no corroboration or no evidence whatsoever, one can only assume that that was her way of planning a defence, although eventually she turned her defence into one of amnesia and finally pleaded guilty in any event. But as said, she does continue to protest that she is innocent of this crime. Although forensically, physically, emotionally, any way you look at it, it would be difficult to establish who else could possibly have done it. So that's all for today. Please visit my website. Please follow me on Twitter. All the links will be put in the episode description. As I've mentioned before, I do not get any money whatsoever for my podcasts. I do this purely in my free time. But if anybody does want to donate, if you go to my website, there is a PayPal link and you can make a small donation of whatever you see fit, 10 pence, a pound, anything, just so that I have some way of keeping this podcast going. It's becoming very difficult, particularly as we all know, we're all suffering from rising prices, etc. But at the same time, I do understand that everybody out there is having the same difficulty. So I want you all to keep warm, keep safe, be kind to each other. Remember that there is some horrendous things going on in the world at the moment. And yeah, take care of yourself. Hope to see you soon.